Welcome to CPA Australia Sound Business, podcasting for business and the accounting profession.
Welcome to today's podcast. My name is Mark Morris and I'm a Senior Tax Counsel with CPA Australia. The topic of today's podcast is estate planning. And it's my great pleasure to welcome today's special guest, Ray Cummings, Principal with Greenoak Advisory. Welcome back, Ray.
Thanks, Mark. Happy to be here.
Well, Ray, we've talked about succession planning in the past. How do you distinguish estate planning from succession planning? I mean, what is the difference between the two?
Mark, to my mind, succession planning deals with assets while you're still alive, whereas estate planning deals with your assets after you've died. There's certainly an argument that estate planning should be a subset of succession planning, but people generally treat them as separate exercises.
Okay. Well, with estate planning, do you think a lot of people put it off?
Oh, look, they certainly do, Mark. There's a multitude of reasons, but the key reason is that people just don't like to contemplate their own death.
Yep.
There are other reasons quite often in the mix. When I ask people why they haven't done it, look, it'll cost too much. They don't know where to start. It's too complicated, and this is a serious comment, they're just afraid of lawyers. They don't want to go anywhere near them.
I'll just show they're prudent. But anyway, so how do you convince someone to go through the estate planning exercise?
Sometimes, but not very often, you can nag and nag, and eventually the client agrees.
Yeah.
I asked the same question of a lawyer colleague recently, and he said he normally tries to scare people into doing it by telling them bad stories. Now, if you think about those, and something you'll appreciate, Mark, that middle-aged men tell each other a lot of horrible stories, you know, about so-and-so, you know, 50 years old, died of a sudden heart attack.
Yeah.
You know, so-and-so riding his bike along Beach Road, got collected by a truck and broke his pelvis and neck and everything else. You know, just horrible stories.
Yes.
More commonly, and unfortunately, the client's only spurred into action following death or serious illness of someone close to them, or in some cases, their own serious illness or near-death experience.
Yeah, in other words, something very close to home.
Absolutely.
So where do you normally start on an estate plan, and what does that process look like?
Look, Mark, the answer to that depends on the complexity of the person's affairs. At a simple level, if all they have is a principal residence and other assets held jointly with their spouse,
yep,
there may not even be any need for a will because those assets pass by, you know, the joint ownership.
Yes.
At the other end of the spectrum, there may be personally held assets, controlled entities, self-managed superannuation funds, insurance policies. Now, in such a case, things are obviously more complex. I follow a process which isn't necessarily anything exotic, but it does give it some format.
Yep. What does that involve?
Look, a few steps. The first one, and perhaps most obvious, is the information gathering, and that is to find out who owns what, yep, basically separating out the personal assets from the controlled assets.
Which often won't be clear in people's minds, will it?
Almost never, Mark. I'm amazed over the years, almost never clear. So establishing that at the outset, then the decision-making, and that is that the person, the client, decides who gets what.
Which could be very important when, I guess, you've got family, member, businesses, et cetera.
Absolutely, dividing it up.
Yeah.
Which actually leads into the next bit, and that is sometimes it's necessary to obtain valuations as people want to ensure that the assets are equally divided. As you say, someone might get the business property, someone might get the business, someone, yeah, might get the principal residence. So if you're wanting to, as an example, divide things equally amongst your children,
yes,
you'd need to go out and do that. And then once you've been through all of that, you get to the implementation, so the drafting of the wills and the other legal documents.
Well, you mentioned the fact you need to take into account controlled entities in that process. Do you find that people sometimes are under the misapprehension that their will takes care of everything?
Look, you've absolutely hit the nail on the head in terms of the critical issues, Mark. I find over and over again, even sophisticated business people think that all they need to do is have a will drafted and that,
yeah,
that takes care of everything. Look, if you take the position of assets held by a family trust, clearly they're not owned by the individual and the trust continues after their death. The assets aren't, or the assets of the trust, aren't dealt with by the will. So it's important to deal with those assets separately where they're owned by controlled entities such as a trust or superannuation funds.
Well, let's just continue the discussion on trusts. If I have assets owned in a family trust, how should I handle these as part of my estate plan?
In many ways, this is quite a complex area. You can leave what is referred to as a letter of wishes for any subsequent trustee, setting out how you wish the income and the capital of the trust to be dealt with after your death. The problem is that this isn't binding. It has absolutely no legal effect.
Yep.
Now, alternatively, you can hardwire it in if you like. You can make provision within the trust deed as to certain critical powers and who should control the trust on your death.
Yep.
Take an example of a position called the appointor to the trust.
Yes.
That's absolutely critical, as this is the person or the entity who essentially controls the trust on your death, because they have the power to appoint and remove the trustee.
So they have oversight, really, of the trust in that sense, don't they?
They certainly do. And the other one that's important is, and it's not in all trusts, but is the position of guardian. Now, quite often, even the appointor or the trustee has to consult with the guardian in respect of certain critical powers under the trust.
Well, still on the subject of trust, we hear quite often about testamentary trusts. What are they and how do you establish one?
At a simple level, they're just trusts created by someone's will that come into existence on their death.
Okay.
The advantages are that normal adult tax rates apply to minors deriving income from testamentary trusts.
Including access to the tax-free threshold and marginal tax rates.
Normal adult tax rates. And they also represent a method to leave assets for the benefit of at-risk beneficiaries, such as business people, who don't want to end up holding assets in their own name. Let's say they've done their asset planning, all the assets are owned by the spouse. Unfortunately, the spouse dies, and if they then leave the assets back to the surviving spouse, there's business risk associated with those assets, whereas if they're in a testamentary trust, they're left less accessible by creditors, shall we put it that way.
So obviously for business people, there's that overlay that needs to be factored in terms of exposure in any planning.
Yep, there certainly is. There certainly is. You need to factor all of those issues in.
Well, turning to another aspect of estate planning, that's superannuation death benefits. What considerations should you take into account in terms of those kind of benefits when you do your estate planning?
Mark, the first thing I'd say is that I won't pretend to be skilled in such a specialist area and clearly go out, find someone who knows about this area.
Look at your CPA Australia website, right? There'll be a lot of superannuation.
Absolutely, Mark. Superannuation specialists. But there are certainly issues and critical issues around binding death benefit nominations and the treatment of amount paid out of the fund on death.
Yes.
And the tax rates, the amount of tax payable, depends on whether or not the recipient is a tax dependent or a non-tax dependent.
Quite markedly different, aren't they?
Absolutely severely different.
So, that should be factored in any planning. In terms of tax returns, what's the process when someone passes on? You've obviously got the deceased return and the estate return to prepare.
That's right, Mark. There's a requirement to lodge a tax return on behalf of the deceased person for the period from 1 July up to their date of death. The first estate tax return then covers the period from date of death up to 30th of June of that financial year. As a broad statement, the estate can then be treated as a separate taxpayer with normal personal marginal tax rates applying for a period of up to 3 years or until until the estate is fully administered. Now, after that point in time, the income within the estate is taxed at the top marginal personal rate.
And that could be very relevant for a range of testamentary trusts that have different income and capital beneficiaries that will be a longer duration.
Absolutely right. They can continue for quite some time beyond that 3-year administration period.
Turning to something else, or probably actually related when I think about it, the financial press often quote statements that capital gains tax operates as a death tax, which I've never really understood. Can you explain that comment?
No, I can't, Mark. I've read the statement over and over as well. The reality is that CGT doesn't operate as a death tax. You know, there are some rules there, but take as an example a pre-CGT asset. The estate or the beneficiaries are considered to have acquired the deceased's pre-CGT assets for their market value at the date of death. They only pay tax to the extent that those assets increase in value after the date of death and are subsequently sold. So if I take an example, if a person had a pre-CGT asset worth, say, $1 million at date of death, their legal personal representative would have a cost base for that asset of $1 million and would then only pay tax if they sold the asset for more than $1 million.
Yep, and only on the amount of that excess over $1 million, obviously.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. What about inherited post-CGT acquired assets?
Look, again, there's no tax arising as a consequence of death. The beneficiaries inherit the deceased's cost base.
Yes.
But they still don't pay any tax until they sell the asset. So, again, if I can give an example, let's say that the asset cost the deceased $1 million. And let's just say that it was worth 1.5 at the date of death. They don't get the 1.5 as a cost base. They get the original $1 million as a cost base. Certainly, if they went out and sold the asset shortly after death for 1.5, they'd pay tax on the $500,000, but not until they sell the asset.
And also, obviously, there's an opportunity now with deceased estates under small business concessions to inherit some of the concessions as well, subject to certain conditions being met. So that's probably another aspect there. What about someone's personal residence? Does that stay free from CGT?
Quite often it's fairly straightforward, as the principal residence will pass to a spouse or a family member who continues to occupy it as their principal residence. So the CGT main residence exemption would be maintained.
Yes.
But in other cases, it can get quite complicated. If the house isn't occupied as someone's residence, the broad rule is that there's a two-year period in which to sell the dwelling following someone's death.
Yes.
And any gain will be CGT exempt. So you might rent it out for 2 years after their death, or it might be unoccupied or what have you for that two-year period and is then sold. But in other situations, there are rules which prorate the gain into a taxable and an exempt component, subject to the use of the property at various points in time. So very broadly, you would prorate it over the holding period into the exempt principal residence use and the income-producing use, for want of a better term, and take that percentage, and that's the portion that would be subject to tax.
They are very complex provisions. It's odd, isn't it, that a lot of people think the principal residence rules are straightforward when actually they're quite intricate.
Some of the hardest questions I've had have been on the principal residence.
I agree. Well, coming back to the process that's involved in estate planning, how do you recommend people go about it? Let's say you have a more complicated situation where you've got multiple assets, family trust and other complications. What's the approach?
In that case, it's obviously advisable to have some type of formal estate planning document. So that's a document or documents that set out who's to get what, the valuation of the assets, the formal legal documents all collected together. It's also useful and perhaps rare, I have to say, for there to be some type of document explaining why particular beneficiaries have received certain assets. So, at least that might reduce some of the arguments after you've gone in terms of the beneficiaries quibbling about who got what and why they got it.
Because clearly it's a financial issue, but it's an emotional one too, isn't it?
Very, very emotional. And look, the other important part of the estate planning process is to always remember that it's not a set and forget. There are many changes in family and personal circumstances, asset holdings and the like, which may require a revision or a complete rewriting of the estate plan, that the really important thing is just to start the process, get it done, yes. not put it off. And you know, I'd certainly commend everyone listening to sit down and do their own, because I think if you ask CPA members how many have actually done theirs, I think you might be surprised at how small a number it is.
Well, I know one who has to go away and do it, and he's very grateful for having this discussion today. Ray, thanks for leading us through again some of the real pragmatic issues that we need to consider in providing advice to clients. Have been very useful. We look forward to seeing you again.
Thanks very much, Mark.